The New Braunfels River is outside of the San Antonio, Austin area. It's near New Braunfels, San Marcos. It is a great place to go rafting, not whitewater rafting. It's really not a lot to get too scared about on the river. It is a perfect river for a lazy Saturday float. It's just a great thing. You just float along. It's gorgeous. It's beautiful. The water is crisp and cool all of the time. But there's this one spot on the river where it makes a bend to the left. And as it's bent through the left through the years, it's eroded up underneath this kind of hillside. I'd call it a cliff. It's 30, 35, 40 feet high. But that is a spot that forever has been a place where all the rafts stop, and you can go up on top and then jump off because the water is good and deep from the erosion, and it's high enough to get your blood going. And so sure enough, I mean, we've done that. So the first time I'm on the New Braunfels River, and I'm out there, there's 20, 30 of us going on, man, the rafts beach. We race up to the top, and to get there one after the other, going off, splash, splash, until it's my turn, and I get up to the edge, and I walk up to the edge, make a fatal mistake, and I stop and I look down. And of course, it looks like the end of the Empire State Building to the bottom. It's forever. And it was one of those rare moments, because I'm usually pretty adventuresome, where I locked up. I froze. I mean, not like completely froze, like I couldn't move, but it's like I couldn't make myself jump. And as in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, I've got two options. I can plunge to my death, right? Or I can walk back down and suffer emotionally relational death and have all my friends despise me for the rest of my life because I'm a wimp and not a man. And so I'm not sure what to do in the moment because both seem somewhat attractive and terrible. And so I'm right at the edge. I'm looking down, and I take a step back, and I finally get back. And in what seemed like hours of just hanging on the edge, I'm sure it wasn't that long. You know, it was probably no more than like 45 minutes. But I was I'm hanging on the edge. And I can hear all my friends, oh, come on, it's going to be great. I'm going, I hate all of you, you know, and I'm on the edge, and more rafts are coming up, and now it's like all of the state of Texas has arrived, and it's right here, until finally I jumped. And, of course, it was great. Oh, yeah, I was never afraid. It was just pausing for dramatic effect and all, you know, it's all these other lies that I spun out at the moment. But I learned a valuable lesson, right? When you face something scary, don't pause, because when you pause, you lock up. You know, you get paralyzed by the fear. So a number of years later, I went bungee jumping. And of course, you'd think I'd learn, right? But no. But so we get up on the bungee platform, and the guy says, look, now, and the instructions are, you're going to get to the edge, and I'm going to say 3, 2, 1 bungee, and you go. And so sure enough, I got up to the edge, and I told everybody, now, here's the key. Don't look down. So I got up. I'm focused straight ahead, and I walk up, and the guy goes, 3, 2, 1 bungee. Woo! Off I go. It's great. Have a wonderful time. Because you kind of have to learn. If you pause, you lock up. And once fear grips you, you're stuck, right? And it's hard to move forward. And some of you are locked up in fear this morning, and the truth be told, you've been here for years. You just, this thing has got you, and you're locked up, and you can't really break through. And the problem is, once fear gets a hold of you, it starts eroding your interiors. It erodes your self-confidence. It erodes your confidence in the Lord. And what happens is you begin internally and sometimes externally to shrink. You know, and you walk a little more stooped, and your backbone's a little more humped, and your heart is shrinking inside because fear has got. Now, the opposite is also true. When you step in to the fear and you take the courageous step, well, you begin to expand. You walk a little taller, walk a little, you know, and your confidence grows. And so what you do with fear has an impact on you. It erodes your relationships. You start pulling back from people, kind of like me on the edge. I'm worried about what everybody's thinking about me. Well, I'm not drawing close to people in a moment like that. I'm withdrawing from people because that's what fear does to us, right? And so what can happen once fear gets a hold of us, if we don't address it, we can be stuck there. And not take any more risks, get stuck in a rut. And for people looking in, they may not be able to tell it, but you can tell it. You can tell. And so all of us in this room struggle with fears. Every one of us do. It's not a question of whether we have fear. It's what do we do with our fear and whether that fear, you know, controls us. I mean, as Dave Barry puts it, and I love the way he writes, he says, all of us are born with a set of instinctive fears. There's the fear of falling. There's the fear of the dark. There's the fear of lobsters. There's the fear of falling on lobsters in the dark, right? There's the fear of speaking in front of the Rotary Club. and the fear of the words, some assembly required, right? And we, all of us have fears. And that's why, because fear is so common. And I can tell you right now, in the room right now, there's a spectrum of fear. Some of you have just a little bit of fear. You're not debilitated. You're not stuck. And some of you are over here, and you're just terrified for the next step. You're terrified of what's, and it's all along the spectrum. So it's all over the room. And that's why in the scriptures, one of the most common commands that God ever gives is do not be afraid. It is over and over and over again. God comes to people like us who are struggling with fear. And he pauses and says, don't be afraid. But he doesn't just leave it there. Because if that's all you say, I mean, you may have had this moment before where you're wrapped up in fear and somebody says, hey, don't be afraid. And at that moment, are you drawn to them and go, oh, thank you so much. I'm so encouraged by you. Right? I mean, you usually say, I hate you and you should die 1,000 deaths. Because all they've done is make you feel crummy. But that's not what God does. What God says is do not be afraid because, and he always ties it to himself. He says, because either I will or I am. I will do this or I will be this. And so this morning, what we desperately need is to deal with some of the fears we have. And because we've been working our way through Acts for the last several months. And Acts is the history of the church and the growth of what's going on. And we're in the middle of sort of a travelogue section where Paul is bouncing all over the place. But tucked away in all of this ministry and travel and geography, there's a little nugget. There's a piece of gold. It's like the cherry in the bowl of fruit cocktail. It's just this wonderful little statement on fear. So grab your Bible, if you would. Turn over to Acts chapter 18. It's about three-fourths of the way through. You'll find it there. Acts chapter 18. And we're going to look at this next little piece of Paul's journey. And so we pull the map up, if you would, Amanda. And here, let me just set the stage for you in a couple of ways. Over the last several weeks, we've been into this little second missionary journey, for those of you who like maps and history and whatnot. Paul started down here in the lower right in Jerusalem. They made a decision on what to do about circumcision and legalism. And he goes up to Antioch up here and makes the report. And then he decides, hey, let's go see our old buds, the ones that we led to Jesus a few years ago. And so he begins this journey to go up here and see his friends. And then as he does that, then he says, hey, let's go tell some new people about Jesus. And they launch up into Asia, this kind of pinkish part. And God says, not here, not here, not here. And he gets them over here and leads them up into Europe for the first time, Macedonia, the kind of orangish thing up in the upper left. And so he goes to Philippi up here in the corner. Up here, he gets beaten and thrown in jail. And there's an earthquake, and that's kind of a bummer deal. They sneak him out of town. He goes down here to Thessalonica, where he gets beaten and are thrown out of town. He goes down here to Berea, and that's good for a little while. And then he comes down here to Athens, and that's okay. And now we find him right here in this little corner of Achaia of Corinth. And Corinth Corinth is like a combination of Vegas and Bourbon Street on steroids. Okay, does that give you a picture? You kind of got an idea. It's a seaport. It's interesting because there's water on both sides. So there's a seaport on both sides, so all of the sailors are coming. It is the most sensual, sexually deviant, morally corrupt city in the Greek area. Matter of fact, in Corinth, up above, behind the city is a hill, and on the hill is the temple of Aphrodite, and Aphrodite is the fertility god, the sex goddess, and every night in Corinth, every night in the evening, 1,000 priestesses, not, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, would come down from the temple to conduct worship services, and essentially were prostitutes. 1,000 of them every night. You know, in the culture, to say you're acting like a Corinthian was basically to say you are a moral deviant. A Corinthian woman was a prostitute. The whole name of Corinth caught this whole picture going on. So Paul finds himself in Corinth because it's a leading city, and he's gone there strategically to tell people about Jesus. And that's where we pick up the story. Look at verse 1 of chapter 18. It says, after this, Paul left Athens, went to Corinth, And there he met a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had ordered all the Jews to leave Rome. And it's another one of those persecutions of the Jews that go on all the time. And so they get thrown out of Rome, and they make their way over to Corinth. Now, Paul went to see them, it says, and because he was a tent maker and they were tent makers, he stayed with them and worked with them. So Paul is in Corinth by himself. He meets these new folks, Priscilla and Aquila. The sense that he leads them to Jesus, but they're tent makers. And so what Paul would do is work tents all week long, and on the Sabbath, on Saturday, he would go to the synagogue and talk about Jesus. And that's why we often refer to people who have a bivocational ministry of they work and do ministry that's tent making because of what Paul's doing here. So he's a tent maker. Now look, verse 4. Every Sabbath, he reasoned in the synagogue trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. Now, eventually, when Silas and Timothy came from Macedonia, Paul devoted himself exclusively to preaching, testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Messiah. Now, Timothy and Silas, they'd been up in Philippi. They come down finally, and when they show up, they bring a huge financial gift. Somebody, or the church in Philippi, maybe Lydia, who was wealthy, sent a bunch of cash down to find Paul, and now this frees Paul up to do full-time ministry. So he no longer does tent making, and it tells us what happens. But and by the way, that's why the letter to Philippians, the book of Philippians in the New Testament, when you read it, it reads just like a thank you note, doesn't it? It's thank you. Here's what I am. This is what God is doing. Thank you for the gift that you sent that has freed me up to serve the Lord. And so it's a thank you note, which will give you a little feel if you're reading it. So he's in the synagogue, but when they in the synagogue opposed Paul and became abusive, he shook out his clothes in protest and said, "Hey, your blood's on your own heads. I'm innocent of it. From now on, I'll go to the Gentiles." So he very dramatically leaves, says, "You're on your own. I tried. You don't want it. I'll find somebody who does." And then Paul left the synagogue, goes right next door to the house of Titius Justus, a worshiper of God, and Crispus, the synagogue leader he just left, and his whole household believe in the Lord and leave the synagogue and come over. And many of the Corinthians who heard Paul believed and were baptized. A little revival breaking out. Now, there is loads of good news going on, okay? Paul gets to Corinth. He's by himself, one of the rare times, but he had to make a run for it. So he's down in Corinth by himself. But then he meets Priscilla and Aquila, and they seem to come to Jesus. Now he's got new partners, new friends he's doing life with. And then Silas and Timothy show up, his buds. They come in, and so now he's got more folks he's doing life and living and courage. He's got the financial freedom now to do ministry full-time. Yeah, it's a little awkward with the Jews. They didn't want it. But, man, everybody else is coming to Jesus like crazy, and there's all these guys like Crispus and Titius Justus, this whole little team that's growing up here, and there is a lot to be grateful for. Life is going well. Paul is, anyway, things are happening. But have you ever had that moment when life is actually going relatively well, and before you know it, fear gets a hold of you, and you're kind of looking around going, "Why am I so afraid right now?" Have you ever had that? Well, that's what happens to Paul. Take a look at verse 9. One night, the Lord spoke to Paul in a vision and says, "Do not be afraid." See, this is what we were talking about a minute ago. Here's the command that God says over and over again in the scriptures, "Do not be afraid." And here's what he says, "For I am with you, and no one is going to attack and harm you, because I have many people in this place." So Paul stayed in Corinth for a year and a half teaching them the word of God. Because now Paul's been moving. If you remember the map, he was moving kind of quickly around, and he lands right here, because what does God say? "Hey, right here, you're safe." Paul says, "I am not leaving town." And there's this moment. But God never says, "Do not be afraid," unless the person he's speaking it to is afraid. For some reason, and it's probably because Paul is expecting things to go south and he's going to get more beatings, Paul's afraid. And what's happened is to Paul and to us is that we become overwhelmed with fear when we give in to the grasshopper syndrome. That's what I've called it through the years, the grasshopper syndrome. And the grasshopper syndrome, I find this in the book of Numbers. So if you don't mind, put a finger here or whatever, grab your app, and turn back to Numbers chapter 13. And Numbers is the fourth book of the Bible. It's Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. So turn back, if you would, to Numbers chapter 13. in the setting of this is that the nation of Israel, they were in slavery in Egypt, you may remember. Moses comes along, the 10 plagues, they're out, they make their way, they go through the Red Sea, God parts the Red Sea, the Egyptian army is drowned. Now they're standing on the banks of the Jordan River. Across the river is the promised land. Across the river is the place that God said, right there, this is the land I'm going to give you. This is the place we're going to establish you. And it's right over that river. Well, Moses, who's in charge at the moment, does a relatively smart thing. He says, okay, none of us have ever been over there. We don't want to just show up cold turkey. I'm going to take 12 leaders of the nation, and I'm going to send you in to spy it out, to go check it out. So that's exactly what happened. Those 12 go in, spread out through the land, check it all out, see who's at home, and then they come back and they give a report. So in chapter 13 of Numbers, verse 27, they give a report. Take a look. Verse 20 says, they gave Moses this account. It says, we went into the land to which you sent us, and you know what? You're right. It does flow with milk and honey. It's an amazing place. And here's some fruit. Take a look at this. And everything sounds hunky-dory until, but the people who live there, they're really powerful. They're big. They're strong. And the cities that we're going to go look at, they're fortified, protected. And the cities and the people, they're really large. Hey, guys, we even saw the descendants of Anak there, and which is a terrifying statement for them. Now, skip down to verse 31, right? Verse 31. But the men who had gone up with him said this. They said, we can't attack those people. Are you nuts? They're stronger than we are. And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land they explored. Oh, and it's all gone. And so that not only are these guys afraid, now the whole nation is afraid, right? Now their fear is contagious. And then they said, the land we explored devours those living in it. All the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim there, the descendants of Anak come from the Nephilim. And he says, we seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we looked the same to them. You see what he's saying? Hey, compared to those guys, we're just a cricket. We're like little bitty Jiminy crickets up against these giants. We're terrified. We're terrified. We are insignificant. We are nothing. We are less than nothing up against what we're looking at. And fear got a hold of them. And they're looking around going, look, we can't do this thing. The job is too hard. The obstacles are too big. The people are too mean. And we are too small. And we are too inadequate. And they're frozen. See, that's what happens when fear gets a hold of you. What you think of yourself gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And what you think of your problem gets bigger and bigger and bigger until it is magnified and huge, and you are microscopic, and you say, it just doesn't fit. We cannot do this thing. And you freeze. And so in that moment, we don't know exactly why. We've got some thoughts on it. That Paul thinks maybe he's going to get some more beatings, it's going to go south on him again. But all of a sudden he's afraid. And God shows up and says, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Earlier in the week, as I was getting ready, I started thinking about who all did God say this to? And so I went back and skimmed through all of the scriptures and figured it out. And so I want to just share the little list of people that God said don't be afraid to. Take a look. It starts with Paul. Just let this soak in. Look at all the names. You're going to recognize these folks. It's a who's who of the Bible. Anybody who is anybody, for the most part, shows up on this list. I mean, we could go on. Does this encourage you like it encourages me? Isn't it somewhat helpful to know that all of the heroes of the faith, that all of the people we look up to, that the whole, that page after page after page after page in this book is someone getting afraid and God coming to someone and saying, don't be afraid. You are not alone in your fear. 29 out of the 66 books of the Bible, God says to somebody, don't be afraid. Fear's normal. We all struggle with it. You sit here this morning and you've got fears. The financial fear, how am I going to pay for this thing that just fell apart on me? How are we going to get that car fixed? Is the doctor going to call on Tuesday? And is that spot going to be more than just a spot? Is our marriage dead? Is there any hope for us? Will I ever be happy again? I used to be happy. Then all this stuff went sideways. Is this my lot for the rest of my life? Age fears, you know, kid fears, or the inability to have kid fears. Fear gets a hold of us, and we shrink to the size of a grasshopper in our own thinking and feel vulnerable and weak and unable. And God comes to the heroes, and he comes to you, and he says, do not be afraid, and let me tell you why. And he gives us four, what he says to Paul is instructive for all of us, and he gives us four thoughts. Turn back to Acts 18, if you're still over in Numbers. So flip back over to Acts chapter 18, and let's return to what God says to Paul, because it is so instructive. Okay? So we've got the whole setting, and look at verse 9. It says, one night, the Lord spoke to Paul in a vision, and he says, do not be afraid. Keep on speaking. Do not be silent, for I am with you, and no one is going to attack and harm you, because I have many people in this city. So Paul stayed in Corinth a year and a half, teaching them the word of God. What is the first thing God says? Do not be afraid. Keep on walking. You see that? Keep on. When you're afraid, the first thing is you got to just keep on walking forward. You got to keep on moving forward, because what wants to happen, what you want to do is lock up and stop where you are. It paralyzes you. And the very first thing he says is don't let yourself get stuck. Take that next step. Whatever that step is, take that step. Move forward. Keep on going. Because it'll... And, now, did you see what he didn't say? What he didn't say is, hey, wait till you're not afraid and then start walking. Which is kind of what we want to do. We want to sit there like, okay, I'm going to be right here and eventually I won't be afraid and then I'll go do something courageous. But like John Wayne always said, right? Courage is being scared to death and saddling up anyway. Courage is stepping into it even when I'm afraid. But what happens is we settle, we get stuck. You know, Colorado Springs, you may not know this, but Colorado Springs exists because people settled, right? The wagon trains were taking off, coming across the plains with the idea of going over the mountains to the coast, and they got to the mountains, and so many people looked up and went, that's just too big. We can't do this, and they just stopped. And some of you men and women, you have stopped. You have settled, and you're stuck. And what God would say to you this morning, I know you're afraid, but take that step. You got to keep moving in spite of the fear. You keep moving even in weakness. You keep taking that next step because the only way through is through. Right? The only way out of this is to keep moving. God, wouldn't it be wonderful if God would come into your life and say, hey, I'm going to take all your problems away. He will. It's called heaven. You're not there yet. Right? And I really believe the process of getting through it is to take whatever the next step is. And so some of you this morning, you know already what step you need to take right now. And you've been stuck here for days, weeks, months, years. There's a phone call you need to make, and you're stuck and terrified. There's a conversation you need to have, and you're stuck and you're terrified. There's a decision you've been putting off for way too long. Way too long. And it's got you by the throat. And what does Jesus say? He says, just keep talking. That's what he says to Paul. That's his step. Just keep going. And it may be what you need to do today is to find somebody else in this room and grab them and say, I need to take a step. And I need you to know it just so I've got it out and it helps me move towards the step I need to take. It may be that you need to text or email or call some safe person so that they can help you take that next step. But you don't get into the promised land until you take the step. If you're stuck on the bank, the only way over the river is over the river. Now, it's really interesting. God parts, I've said this before, God parts the waters a couple of different ways. In Exodus, at the Red Sea, and Moses just holds up his staff and stands there, and the waters part, and they go through on dry land. But in Joshua, years later, after they decide not to go in here, when they need to part the Jordan River for the millions of people to go through, what has to happen is the priests have to walk down into the flowing river, and they have to stand here. Because God's not parting it here. He's stopping the water upstream, and they have to wait for it to pass. And it doesn't stop until they walk into it. Men and women, some of you need to take a step today. I don't know what your step is. You know what it is. And you need to take that step to conquer the fear that has a hold of you. All right, look at what happens next. Right? Look at what God says next. Do not be afraid. Keep on speaking. Do not be silent, for I am with you. What are you doing? You're afraid. The second thing is keep believing that God will never leave you or forsake you. You are not alone. I mean, it may seem like you are. You know, again, he's not going to take the struggle away. God never says, hey, I'm going to take it away. He says, I'm going to be with you in the struggle. I mean, what are some of the greatest verses of the scriptures that we know? Psalm 23. What does he say? The good shepherd says, even though I walk through the valley of death, I will fear no evil. Why? For you are with me. The darkest valley you're going to go through ever, you never go through it alone. The end of Jesus' life, in the book of Matthew, the very last thing Matthew records that Jesus said, says, I'm going to send you out into the whole world, but don't be afraid, because lo, I am with you always. Night before Jesus dies, he's got all his buds around. He says, man, here's where we're headed. There's going to be death, and there's going to be sadness, and you're going to struggle, and once I'm, you know, and he says, look, I will be with you, and I will give you peace. Hebrews tells us that God says that never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. When you walk through the fire, God is with you. See, but here's the problem. In the middle of fear, you feel completely alone. You feel totally isolated because in your mind, and it's actually somewhat true, you begin to think nobody gets it. Nobody knows what I'm feeling. And you know what the truth is? We don't know. We want to care. We really do. But we can't feel what's happening in here. We don't know what you're going through, really. But that's the promise of Jesus. The promise of Jesus is that he knows exactly what you're going through. He says, I will never leave you. And what we tend to think so often is, I'm afraid, and God withdraws and says, when you get it together, when you get some courage, I'll be back. But what does he say? Oh, don't be afraid. And he moves towards us and says, I'm with you. You are not alone in whatever it is you're facing. Look at what Corrie Ten Boom said at the top of the line. She said, if you look at the world, you'll be distressed. If you look within, you'll be depressed. But if you look at Christ, you'll be at rest. It's cleverly stated. It's a beautiful thing. But she's right. Start looking out here at your obstacles, oh my gosh, you're going to give up. You start looking inside, all you see is a grasshopper. It's not until you look at Jesus. And you may, I don't know how many of you know who Corrie Ten Boom is, but let me give you a 30-second promo on Corrie Ten Boom. Corrie Ten Boom lived in the Netherlands in World War II. And her family, who were Christians, not Jews, but Christians, they created basically a safe place called the Hiding Place. And they helped dozens and dozens of Jews and other resistance fighters be safe in their home. And eventually word got out, and Corrie Ten Boom and her family, she was still young, they all got arrested and taken off to concentration camps. And she was arrested and then locked away in the concentration camp for years because they were helping the Jews. And at one point, and eventually her sister Betsy even died in the concentration camp. And what her sister Betsy said at one point, let me just read it because I wrote it down in between service. I went and got it because I want to make sure I get it. Said, "There is no pit so deep that God is not deeper still." Powerful words from a concentration camp. So when Corrie Ten Boom writes about what it means to walk forward in fear and have God with you, and this is not a Hallmark sympathy card. This is a woman in the concentration camp who gets it that in the darkest hellhole of life, Jesus is there. You know, Jesus is there. And no one else gets it, but he does. He sees you, he knows you, and he is near to you. And right now, men and women, as you sit here right now, Jesus is closer to you than any of us. He's right here in this room. And I've been spending the last year really trying to create an awareness in my own soul of Jesus' nearness. I get it. I know the words. I know Psalm 23. But I have been trying to consciously stop multiple times through the day with the reality of Jesus, you are right here. You're right here. I don't have to ask you to come, which I used to always, Jesus, would you come? Like he's off somewhere on an errand. You know, I have to beg him to come around. He's right here, right now, right here where you are. He's here with you. He was waiting for you when you walked in. He was waiting for you when you woke up. He is right with you. And he hears your prayer, and he draws near in your fear and will never abandon you, no matter how big the obstacle is. Take a look at the third thing that says. It says that God says, don't be afraid. Keep on speaking. Don't be silent, for I am with you. And look next. And no one is going to attack and harm you. What I see it here is that when you're facing fear, you got to keep believing that God will fulfill every promise he has made to you. That if God made a promise, and now this is great news for Paul, because everywhere he's gone, the pattern is the same, right? He goes into town, he goes to the Jews, he talks to the Jews reject Jesus, reject him. He leaves the Jews, starts talking to the Gentiles, the Greeks, and all the pagans. These people start coming to Jesus, which makes all the Jews jealous. Then the Jews kind of rally up, and they start beating up on Paul, throwing him in jail, whatever thing. But he loves his people. So in the next city, he does the same thing. But now, he's got this Pavlovian response, right? I do this, then this, then this, then this, and then I get a beating. Right? I mean, it's been the pattern. I get thrown out of town. I get run out of town. I get threatened every time. And so where he is in the pattern. He's gone to the Jews. He's been rejected. He stepped aside. And now it's kind of like, he's starting to get the twitch. The beatings are coming. Right? I mean, do you guys have this? Do you have the phone call twitch? How many of you guys have this thing, right? That little moment where your phone rings, right? Because you've got a sick parent somewhere. And every time the phone rings, you knee-jerk in fear. Or you've got a customer who's a jerk. And every time the phone rings, you kind of nod up inside, or you've got kids that are wayward, right? I mean, you guys have this besides me? I mean, man. But it's this conditioned response, I think, where Paul, as it reached his point, was going, oh, here we go again. He's afraid. Because, again, he's looking out to the future. And he goes, okay, here's where we're headed. Because, see, worry is always looking at your future and leaving God out. Right? Do you ever look forward and go, oh, I can see God doing great things in my life? No, you know, you look at your future and go, oh, my gosh, we're all going to hell in a handbasket, right? Because God's not out there in your future, in your mind. And that's what's happening to Paul. And so God shows up, and he makes this great promise. He says, Paul, right here, it's a time and space deal, right here. Paul, right here, no one's going to attack you. No one's going to harm you. Now, this isn't for the rest of his life, because we know he's going to get attacked and beaten at other places. But right here, he says, in this place, in this time, safety.
Which explains in my mind why Paul doesn't leave Corinth. Right? I mean, at first, with that, with verse 11, oh, so he stayed for a long time because he's safe right here. But there's this promise, but it gets tested. Look at verse 12. While Gallio, the governor, was governor proconsul of Achaia, the Jews of Corinth made a united attack on Paul. He goes, oh, here we go. And they brought him to the place of judgment. He goes, well, here we go. You know, beaten. And verse 13, they say, this man is persuading the people to worship God in ways contrary to the law, really, of the Romans. And just as Paul was about to speak, Gallio said to them, if you Jews were making a complaint about some misdemeanor or serious crime, I'd care. He said, it would be reasonable for me to listen to you, but since it involves questions about words and names of your own laws, settle them out of yourselves. I will not be a judge of such things. I don't care, is what he's saying. And really what he's saying is, Paul, you're safe right here. They can't touch you right here. And so, look, this is pretty funny. So he drove them off. Then the crowd, who just needed to beat somebody, evidently, then the crowd there turned on Sosthenes, the synagogue leader, and beat him in front of the proconsul, and Gallio looked at him and went, whatever. I don't care. You know, you want to go beat somebody else? Beat your friends up. I don't care. Right? But you might want to underline Sosthenes. You look over to 1 Corinthians, and when Paul writes back to these folks, he says, hey, I just wanted to let you know that your brother Sosthenes is a great co-worker in the gospel. Now, maybe there were just a whole lot of people named Sosthenes back in the day, but I don't think so. I think Sosthenes gets a beating here, and he looks around going, here are my peeps, and there's no love. And here are the Christians, and there's a lot of love. And he gives his life to Jesus and becomes one of Paul's traveling companions. Sometimes we have to get a beating in life before we open ourselves up to Jesus. Right? But God makes his promise to Paul. He says, nobody's going to lay a hand on you. And then all of a sudden, it's tested, and he goes, wow, thank you, God. Thank you, God. And that is a promise for Paul. It's for Paul alone. It's for in that time and space. But the scriptures are filled with promises. God has made hundreds of promises to you. And you got to cling to those in the midst of the fear. Right? Years ago, I made a list. Okay, what I think are the greatest promises? And I think the five greatest promises in scripture is when God says, I have a great plan for your life. You have purpose. And when God says, I will forgive you. I have grace for you. He says, I am with you always. I'll never leave you. It's the presence of Christ. When God says, I will give you strength and endurance to face whatever's coming your way. And he says, I'm preparing a place for you. There's more to life than what you see. That this isn't the end of life in this life. And these are universal promises. And a key to surviving fear is to grab a hold of a promise. And so what I want to encourage you to do, if you find yourself in the middle of the fear, to sit down and say, Jesus, because what we usually say is take away all the stuff. Let me encourage you to say, Jesus, would you give me the promise I need for this situation? Jesus, would you give me the promise I need for today? And it may be that you need a new promise every day, or it may be that Jesus will bring to your mind a specific problem, a promise that you will cling to like a life rope that will carry you through the entire thing. And it may be some promise from Scripture that he is going to surface up for you that you hadn't even been thinking about, but it's exactly what you need. Because God is a promise-giving God and a promise-keeping God, and he will keep every promise he's ever made to you, no matter how big the obstacles or how small you feel. All right, one last thing. Take a look at this last thing. He says, do not be afraid. Keep on speaking. Keep on walking. Do not be silent, for I am with you, and no one is going to attack you and harm you, because I have many people in this city. See what he's saying? Keep believing God's purpose for you that never changes. That God has a plan. God has a purpose. God has something for your life. He has a calling on your life. Early on, when Paul first came to Christ, what God said to him is, God said, Paul, I'm going to use you to take the good news of Jesus to the Gentiles and to the ends of the earth, the people who have never heard. And he's looking. He's in Corinth, and there's all these pagans everywhere who are just sexually deviant. And what does he say? Your purpose, Paul, your purpose is still in play. I know it looks terrible. It's a lousy place to be. But there are people right here that I'm going to use you to reach. Go to work. The fields are ripe unto harvest. Go to work. Trust me. Remember why I put you here. And he's saying, be courageous in the purpose I've given you. And men and women, every one of you have a purpose from God. Every one of you have a calling from God. All of you have been shaped by God and called by God for something. Right? God could have put you anywhere in time. He put you now. He could have put you anywhere on the planet. He put you here. So you are here now for a reason, not by accident. It's not random. God placed you in Lafayette in 2017 because he has a purpose for you here. You have a calling from God, and it hasn't faded away but just because you have obstacles. And the calling of God is both invigorating and terrifying. It fires us up. I'm called to this thing. And it's just like, there's a sense of purpose. There's a sense of partnering with God. There's a sense of being used by God. And it just fires us up and moves us forward. But it's also terrifying because God never calls you to something simple. He calls you to something huge, something God-sized. So that when you look at it, you go, yeah, what he's got the 12 spies and we're all going to the promised land. And they're all going, piece of cake. No. Look at the obstacles. We're little, they're big. He goes, yeah, it'll be great. Trust me with this thing. So often the calling of God, when you see it for your life, that next thing he's calling you into, you're going, oh, my Lord, I can't do this. Well, of course you can't by yourself, but through you he can. Ephesians 2:10 says it so well that God has created good works for us to do that we have to walk into. God says, I've got a job for you. Your purpose hasn't changed regardless. It's a God-sized deal. And you got to step into it. And it's real. God says, don't be afraid. He says four things. If you're afraid today, you need one of these four. Keep on walking. Some of you are stuck and you need to take a step. Right? Or maybe it's the presence of God. You just don't believe. You feel alone and he's right there with you. Or maybe there's some promise that you need to cling to be able to kind of hang on and keep moving. Or maybe it's a sense of purpose that you've just lost. You just feel like you have nothing to give, but you need one. Take a look at those four. I know some of you already folded up and put it away because you filled in your last blank, but open that puppy up. Take a look at it. Which of these four did God have for you today? Why are you here? What did he want to say to you out of these four? And now why don't you take a minute and talk to him about that. Just you and him in the silence of your heart. Deal with those four.